copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
First session speaker are David and Mark, and the topic today is music and devotion. May God give you strength and wisdom as you share.
Thank you. I just want to welcome everyone and also wish a good morning and good afternoon. We're grateful to be with you here again. I'd like to start by telling a story briefly. You don't need me to tell you that recently we've all learned how fragile our plans can be and how easily overturned our plans can be. Well, David and I had big plans for the spring of this year. We were going to do a series of live events where we would talk about concerts that the symphony was performing and take the music and address both the artistic side of it and the theological side. And of course, all of those concerts were canceled. And because the concerts were canceled, so were the talks to explore the music. And after recalibrating a little bit, we came up with an alternative, or David did, which was, why don't we have the conversations and just record them and create a podcast out of it? And that quickly snowballed, and over Holy Week, this podcast was broadcast on the radio, and it's now available online. We took a piece of music, Bach's St. John Passion, which sets to music the Passion account in John's Gospel, going through the text of chapter 18 and chapter 19, also bringing in other texts to reflect on the narrative. And we took that work and we went through it similar to the way that we did yesterday. We listened to the work and then we unpacked its artistic merits and also its theological weight, its value for devotion. You probably picked up already from yesterday's session that in the relationship with David and I, David is the expert where music comes from, and I'm the neophyte. As a novelist and a pastor, though, I'm used to speaking authoritatively about things that at best I only half understand. So together, we were able to work through this piece of music. And what was striking to me about it was the need that we have as believers to be able to bring together these two ideas that we're speaking of this morning, music and devotion. That as much as I want to look at Bach's St. John Passion as a great monumental work of art, in times like these, maybe the way that we need it most is as a work of devotion or an act of worship that we can enter into. And so that's what we'd like to do this morning is talk about sacred music, but talk about it differently. Talk about the way that this rich tradition of music can actually be of value to us as believers, as artists in particular, to be nourished by it and inspired by it and led by it. I think, especially now, as we're having this global conversation about what it looks like to come back together at some point. What will worship look like in the post-COVID world? What will singing in worship be like, given the risks that are now associated with group singing? These are all questions that we're struggling with. And again, I think all the more reason to be thinking about the use of this music. And really, we'll try to talk about this in two distinct ways. So there's the public use of this music in worship that we want to touch on, but then there's also the private devotional use, what this music can mean to us as believers as we come to appreciate it. As I think about that, I guess we'll explore this a little, but one thing to just keep in mind is this. We have this rich tradition of beautiful, complicated, God-exalting sacred music that is kept alive today, mainly outside the church. That the desire that people have to see this music live on is a desire that's mainly located in concert halls, not in sacred spaces. And so we want to think about maybe the need that we have in our sacred spaces for music like this, and also for music that thinks the way this music does, that functions the way that this music does. So that's kind of where we want to go. That's the abstraction. And to put concrete flesh on those bones, we want to look at some music. So I think we'll start with Bach, with the St. John Passion. And David, why don't you maybe set up for us just a little bit the significance of what we're going to be listening to?
Yeah, sure. The other thing to keep in mind is, you know, yes, we have this rich tradition of music, centuries worth actually, but just think about what would it look like, sound like, if the church were committed to this kind of artistic expression and worship today. I often ask myself, since the great divorce, at least in my mind, of the church and art over the last century in particular, like, what music was never composed? What paintings were never painted? What buildings were never built because of the abdication of the church, pretty much universally, certainly in terms of its leadership across all denominational fronts, the commitment to the production or the creation of this kind of worship. And so, you know, when we look at St. Bach's St. John Passion, it's important to know that this didn't happen just out of the blue. I mean, Bach was the genius, maybe the greatest musician to ever walk the face of the planet. But there was a tradition already over 100 years old in Germany, in the Lutheran Church, of having passions composed by composers for Good Friday. Bach just happened to up the ante significantly and pretty much destroy anybody who came after him in terms of this. But so just to set the stage, as we begin to listen to some of this music, imagine that you're in Leipzig in 1726 and you're going to church on Good Friday. Chances are the last time you heard any music at all would have been the previous Sunday when you went to church, unless you made the music yourself. I mean, there were no recordings. You might have sang some drinking songs in the beer hall over the course of the week, but it was a pretty quiet, relatively quiet world that you would have lived in. So just imagine how fresh upon the ear this music would have sounded going to church on Friday afternoon or evening, as the case was. And, you know, you're there for hours. Hours. I mean, the St. John Passion is 2 hours worth of music, but there was preaching in there as well. You know, this was a big event. So as we dig into this, use your imagination as to what it would have felt like, what your heart would have been, how it would have been moved by experiencing this music.
Yeah. Yeah, it's still astonishing to me to think this was a church service, number one, that you would have experienced this music in. And number two, that music like Bach's, and like all of this sacred music we'll be talking about, for the most part, it emerges out of a church culture that supports it. You know, Bach was not some rogue artist who busted into the church and somehow forced the authorities to let him do a musical thing this Friday. This was a long-standing tradition where you might think of it this way, that in my theological tradition, you know, we emphasize what we call the ordinary means of grace. You know, we have the preaching of the word, the sacraments, and prayer. And these rails are all supported within the liturgical culture of the church, informing worshipers. And I think it would be fair to say that what we've tended to do, and certainly by the 21st century in the church, is to emphasize only one. We still have a culture that forms people to minister the word. Sacraments and prayer and sung prayer, music and worship, those things are left to themselves to a greater degree. And as a result, we don't have a culture that forms those to listen, but also those to sing in the same way that it used to be. So maybe with that in mind, why don't we turn ourselves to the St. John Passion, and we're going to listen to, it'd be great to listen to it all, but we're going to listen to one particular moment, which is the arguably the best moments, not only in the St. John Passion, but in all of Bach. And it is the aria, "It is finished, es ist vollbracht," which is an aria after the death of Christ and those words that he utters, "It is finished." So when you think about that moment, which takes place in John's Gospel, chapter 19, verse 30, when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished," and he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. You think of those words of Christ on the cross and what they mean to you, and the layers of meaning when he says, "It is finished." This music captures the complexity of those words well, and we'll unpack some of the meaning behind that as we listen.
So, a passion of Bach, there are two that have survived. The St. Matthew Passion is actually the bigger of the two. But it's structured so that like Mark said, the entire narrative of these two chapters in John is set to music. It's also, there are moments, well, you have characters. You have the evangelist, you know, who sings the words, a tenor soloist who sings the words of the gospel. You also have a chorus that's rather schizophrenic. At times, the chorus reflecting on what's happening and in a devotional way, but at other times they're personifying the crowd that is calling for Christ's crucifixion in a very dramatic way. So Bach draws on a lot of different influences, such as the world of opera, and brings this into his musical expression. There are also devotional arias by different soloists, and then there are chorales, where it's the congregational participation moment, where Bach will take a familiar tune, and then set it. His harmonic setting of it is different every time. Like we know the hymn, "O Sacred Head, Thou Wounded." At least that's the English translation. But within the St. Matthew Passion, he uses that, I think, 6 or 7 times throughout the course of the Passion, but it's harmonized totally differently at every time. It's a very fresh approach. So the sophistication, even though the congregation is singing a familiar tune, the setting of it is revolutionary. So at this particular moment, the tenor, the evangelist, has just sung, and Jesus bowed his head and said, you know, it is finished. And then we have this reflective aria for alto. In the case of the recording we're going to listen to now, this is a countertenor. So this is a man singing in a high voice, which was not uncommon at all in Bach's time. it is looking at it as a listener, there are a couple of things to notice. One is the instrumentation. So you have an organ that's accompanying, and you have a solo viola da gamba. And for some of you, this may be your first experience hearing a viola da gamba, somewhat related to the cello, but a very unique sound, a very expressive sound. And the gamba and the voice are in dialogue with one another. The melodic line you will hear is largely gestures that are descending. So it's a painting of Christ's head bowing when he says it is finished. The only word that is on a rising melodic line is the word trost, which is comfort. So it is finished is the text. Oh, comfort for the sin-laden soul. That's the text that the alto is singing here. So this is the very first section of this aria. Es ist vollbracht, or it is finished. Whoops. Let's start at the beginning. So that's just a taste of that first part. This is what is known as a da capo aria. We talked a little bit about form yesterday in Beethoven and how he would present two contrasting themes, and then they would play against each other. Well, this is before Beethoven. But there's still this section, this da capo aria. Da capo means to the head or back to the head. So you have it's an ABA form. So you have, this is the A part that we just listened to. In the B section, you have a very contrasting musical idea, and then it returns to the A with da capo, back to the head, back to the A section, which is the music that you just heard. So just to sample this a little bit, well, actually, we're going to hear the B section. It's quite short. Total contrast. My favorite moment in all of Bach, because it comes like a bolt of lightning, seemingly out of nowhere, in the midst of this very contemplative music. All of a sudden, we have what in Baroque opera convention would be known as a battle aria or a rage aria. It would have been more common to have heard in an opera like Julius Caesar of Handel. Or something, you know, like going to war. And the text that Bach is setting here is Der Held aus Juda siegt mit Macht. The hero of Judah triumphs in might, and he must win the battle. So again, using your imagination, you're just hearing this music that you've just heard, and then out of nowhere, this is what we hear. So, da capo, back to the head, back to the original music from the beginning of the aria. But I mean, what the heck? Right? I mean, like, where does this come from? But I think, you know, Mark, don't you think it's to make this point that this is actually not a defeat? This is a triumph.
Right. And I think it captures, in a way, artists can relate to, where it's not only the text, but the form that he gives it that captures the almost paradoxical way that Christians understand what happens at the cross. Right? So you get the sense of lament and the need to be comforted, but that triumphant cry of victory bursts in and interrupts it, right? And reminds us of the significance of what has taken place. And again, in a way that I feel like, especially now, our hearts are open to, that we can feel very much the sense of the lament and the yearning for comfort, and need very much the interruption. We need very much the aria of triumph as a reminder and a sustainer of us. I guess the thing I can't help thinking, though, is why can't church be like this now? You know, what would it take for us to have nice things like this again? You know,
and what would they sound like? You know, we don't.
Right.
Have,
I mean, that,
we're not looking
exactly
at the music of Bach.
Right.
We're looking at a contemporary expression of this, and you know, part of the great divorce has to do with modernism and the way that artists have turned towards atonality and music and you know, dissonance in various ways within painting and sculpture and all of that. If you're a Francis Schaeffer devotee, I mean, he unpacks this a lot. But the church still could, right, could commission works of art that have beauty and power. I mean, we can set the parameters without strangling the artist. Mm-hmm. This is another thing, Mark, you and I have talked about this quite a bit, is like this sort of abdication to, like, well, the world of contemporary art is like, well, the artist has to express themselves in their own way, and that's the only thing that matters.
Right. Right? Yeah, and I think, so looking at this from the standpoint of a pastor with liturgy to put together, worshipers to lead, I recognize that in all that we do in worship, there is a formation that's taking place, right? There's a formation that takes place through the ministry of the word. There's a formation that takes place through the act of worship, and everything that's part of that worship service. What I want to be is more intentional about forming worshipers. And that's where my interest in music comes in, because it does seem to me that what we've done for the most part is allow that formation to take place elsewhere. So that when we think about music in church, we think primarily through the lens of taste. We think primarily, like, what do people already like to hear? And let's give them that. Now, if our seminaries were teaching homiletics with a similar philosophy, we would be appalled. But for some reason, we forget that music is forming a similar function. And this is the sung prayer of God's people and intentionally should be chosen. And I would say not only for, let's say, its lyrical value, but for its beauty, you know, for its value in shaping the heart. And so there's I would say, a very practical ministry motivation for approaching music and worship very differently than we do. Recognizing it is absolutely not about preserving great art of the past. You know, we're not talking about putting velvet ropes up so that we can all behold the beauty of what has gone before us, but actually taking a similar kind of mindset, you know, using the gifts that God has given us to glorify Him in fresh ways. That's what I want to try to encourage, and how, as an artist, I would like to be encouraged by the church.
Right. Well, I think often about the standard to which we hold our pastors and those who are preaching the word to us. We expect the highest level that we can get in the in expository preaching, or, you know, teaching of the word. Like everything that you as a pastor can bring to bear, all of the research, all of that, whatever we can handle, we want that highest level. But when it comes to the other aspects of worship, if you're thinking of worship as the preaching of the word being a part of the worship and the rest of it also being worship and not just a warm-up act for the sermon,
right?
You know, then you have to apply a different standard. As I said to a previous pastor of mine, I've never had to be this mean to you, Mark, but it's like, you know, Randy, you're serving haute cuisine to us Sunday after Sunday in the pulpit, but we're eating mud pies in the parking lot as an appetizer, you know? So the disconnect is quite huge.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess my hope for this moment is, I think we understand that we're not going to go back to normal, right? We're not just going to flip a switch and everything's going to go back to the way that it was in the pre-COVID world. That what's going to happen is things will be rebuilt and they will be put back together either with intention or without. And what I aspire to is to try to put things back together with greater intention in this way, that as we're forced to think about the role of music in worship, let's not just think of it in terms of risks, but in terms of opportunity, you know, in terms of beauty.
It takes more effort. It does. You know, it takes some education. But to your earlier point, are we forming or are we being formed?
Right.
As a church. Right. Right, our congregations should be being formed and informed by the a very, very comprehensive approach to worship.
Right, and I think so. That's you know, the public use of worship music, but could we switch gears a little and think about the private devotional use of music? I'm just curious. I mean, I've had this experience. I'm sure people can relate, where some of the most exalted and transcendent experiences of worship that I've had in recent years have been at concerts. Mm. And, you know, David will do Arvo Pärt on a Saturday night, and then we'll be in church together on Sunday, and I'm feeling the fact that he maybe led more worship than I did. You know, and so there's a way that, regardless of the state of things publicly and what it takes to do that, we're each of us as believers have this ability to use this music well. So how would we do that, though?
Well, we can actually take a historical approach to it. I don't I think we need contemporary forms of worship, but it doesn't hurt at all to look at the sort of comprehensive view of how the church has engendered the highest form of musical worship over centuries. So I put together several clips here of different sanctuses from different composers over the course of the last 250 years or so. So the first example I have is from Bach's Mass in B minor. The Sanctus is the Holy, 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 you know, Lord God Almighty. It's a Latin text, but that's what they're singing. So in this first example from Bach, you can hear the cherubim and seraphim before the throne of God in heaven singing Holy, Holy, Holy. There's a swingingness to this music that is like the incense that is before the throne of God in heaven. It's joyous music, but also evocative of that scene in Revelation chapter 4, I believe, right? Here we go. Hear what I mean? The swinging? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. We have a question in the comments I just want to bring up so we don't forget this. The question is, how can we connect classically trained Christian artists who are crying out for these ideals for church and worship to you? And that made me think you should definitely say something about crescendo.
Yeah.
So make a note. You know?
Yeah, I will. I don't want to get so. We're working on that. That's the thing. And I'll just say you heard a bit about crescendo from Beat Rink on Sunday when we began this. But this is a ministry that's been going since the mid '80s, led by Beat and his wife Irie, and it's a continent-wide ministry in Europe, which is now spilled over into a music school in Rwanda, a summer institute in South Africa, and activities in China. But I am working with Beat to try to bring crescendo to the U.S. Because of its very unique DNA, the way that it ministers. But it's basically a movement. It's a movement among professional musicians, classical and jazz musicians. And it's borne a lot of fruit in Europe. I encourage you to check out Crescendo International. I think it's just crescendo.org is the website, and all these various activities like the Night of Faith that Beat talked about on Sunday. The idea is, one of the ideas of behind Crescendo is that we can actually help the church learn how to worship better, you know, differently. More comprehensively, like we're talking about. Here's another example of another Sanctus. This one is from Mozart. So Mozart, an Enlightenment composer, not so long after Bach, but in Austria and under the it would have so most. This is from Mozart's Requiem, and there's a lot of mysteries around the composition of the Requiem. He left it unfinished, his last composition, but he lived his life writing sacred music for the Catholic Church in Austria. It was a main benefactor of his compositionally. But the picture that Mozart, again, this would have been, the masses that Mozart composed would have been used in worship. You know, you can actually hear it if you go, like, you know, to the Salzburg Festival You can actually go to a church service there and actually hear an entire mass of Mozart being used in worship. But this, his take on the Sanctus is a royal take. It's definitely the kingship of Christ that's being celebrated here. Yeah, you can hear the majesty in the music, right?
Definitely. Yeah. Very, very Mozart.
Very, very Mozart. Not a bad thing.
Not at all.
Yeah. If you fast forward several decades and move to France, here's another Sanctus written by Hector Berlioz. It's also from his Requiem. But his take on it is personal. It's more reflective. It's interesting because Berlioz, he was quite devoted Catholic when he grew up, but by the time he wrote his Requiem, he was a self-proclaimed atheist. Mm-hmm. Yet, he set this Requiem text in a very sensitive way. So one can hope that within him was still an aspect of devotion. It's shocking, and sorry, it's like cutting it off. I never figured out how to fade out the, you know, in these clips. But so, Mark, in terms of devotion, now we've heard three different settings of holy, holy, holy. I know how I would approach it, but it's like it's musically and historically informed. It still evokes worship within me. But for yourself, like listening to that, you know, how would people, for lack of a better word, use this?
Right. Yeah. It's a good question. I feel like I've experienced enough of this where on a good day I could conduct a Latin mass. I may not understand what it's saying, but you get the words kind of in your head. But the texts are familiar ones. The music gives you a way to meditate on that familiar text so that it becomes like a a smooth stone, you know, smooth by rubbing and kind of thinking through and that sort of thing. And so I think the quality for personal devotion that I appreciate myself the most is that sense of going back over the familiar, like letting it sink more deeply in, you know, and so repeated listening and also the value of hearing the same text set by very different composers. And surprisingly, having strong opinions about which is right and which is wrong and all of that comes along with it. But
we can also give thanks for the music and where it takes us. We can give thanks for the work of art, for the gifts of God that are given to the composer first, I would say, and then also to the people who are reproducing it. I mean, as a performing artist, I'm just a recreator, you know, I'm not a creator. Like, it's my job to bring to life something that's been composed, you know, and this is the whole world of classical music. It's music that's written for other people to perform. Mm-hmm. This is very different from popular music, which is generally written as a vehicle for the performer. But in my world, it's actually distasteful to self-aggrandize through the music that you're performing. You know, a Beethoven concerto or something. If you have a soloist that's like all over the place and trying to draw attention to themselves, the rest of the orchestra is kind of like, oh, please give me a break. We're here to serve Beethoven. We're here to serve the music. It's a God-given gift. So it's a balancing act. So when I hear a performance of this music, I can celebrate on so many different levels the gifts that God has given. So before we end, let's just take a little trip into what this sounds like in a contemporary way. I have three short clips from a Berlin Mass by the Estonian composer Arvo Pärt, who is still alive. If you had a chance to look at the readings that were attached to these sessions, four separate articles, the last one talks about chant and going back to chant. And so in Arvo Pärt, you have somebody who in his early career was a high modernist composer, left it all and dug deep into his Orthodox background and the music and brought a very contemporary take on it, but still very much connected to tradition. So here is the Kyrie from his Berlin Mass. So this is music that is actually a catalyst for worship. Here is his take on the Sanctus. So a very different take on the Sanctus, very reflective. And finally, this is the Agnus Dei, Lamb of God, which takes away the sin of the world. Whoops. start from the beginning. So it's possible, yeah, to have a contemporary expression, although this is largely done in concert, maybe even in a church, but not for the worship service itself.
Right, right. It's good.
Yeah. Thank you all for, thank you all for listening, and I hope it's food for thought and some inspiration for some exploration.